Good day, everyone, and welcome to Breaking Down the Problems conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. Please note, I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Michelle Waslin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Megan, and thank you all of us for joining us. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Welcome to the IPC call on the problems with the current immigration system. As we begin a new round of immigration debate across the country, we believe that we need a clear understanding of how and why the system is broken in order to come up with fair and practical solutions. Over the next few minutes, our speakers are going to lay out what's wrong with the current immigration system and how recent attempts at immigration enforcement have been ineffective. We want to point out that the system is broken beyond the fact that there are 11 to 12 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. There are structural failures inherent in the way the current legal immigration system is designed, and the inadequate responses have led to new and different problems for immigrant communities and all Americans. So we need to begin a discussion about some of the other symptoms of our broken immigration system and what living without any federal intervention has done to our nation over the last 20 years. We need to discuss why the enforcement-only response has been wholly inadequate and harmful. So this is not meant to be an exhaustive list of all of the push and pull factors that lead to migration, nor all of the problems with the current system, but these are the most immediate issues that we believe must be addressed with comprehensive immigration reform. The paper that the IPC is releasing today is divided into a brief overview of the current visa system, an examination of the structural problems with the system, and finally, the inadequate responses that have been tried. This paper is available right now on our website, immigrationpolicy.org, and the paper will be followed up with a series of solution papers over the next couple of weeks, looking at the many different solutions to the many different aspects of the immigration system. So let me just go on and introduce our speakers for today. First, we have Crystal Williams, who is the new executive director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and Crystal is going to talk to us about the current visa system and its shortfalls. Next, we'll have Marshall Fitz, who is director of immigration policy at the Center for American Progress, and he will discuss the broken immigration system's impact on U.S. workers and U.S. businesses. Then, Mary Giovannoli, who is director of the Immigration Policy Center, will discuss the limitations of our current immigration laws and the agencies that implement them. And finally, I will come back and discuss the failed enforcement measures. Our speakers will each present for about 5 minutes, and then we will open up your lines for questions. So, Crystal, you want to go ahead?
Certainly. Thank you, Michelle. When we're talking about the immigration system, it's important to understand first how the existing system works to understand why it isn't working. Under our existing system, family or employment sponsorship is pretty much the only way for a non-refugee to get a green card. These sponsorships are divided into some very specific and narrow categories called preferences. On the family side, you must have a close family relationship to a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, and even then, you may have to wait as long as 20 years for that application to finally be processed because of the quota system, which I'll get to in a minute. That close family relationship means you must be a child or a spouse of a U.S. citizen or permanent resident, or a sibling of a U.S. citizen. Parents of U.S. citizens also qualify, but the U.S. citizen must be at least 21 years old before a parent can even begin the process of obtaining permanent residence through the child. For employment, you must already have been identified by a U.S. employer, which then must pursue a costly and cumbersome process that bears little resemblance to the real world in order to secure a permanent visa for you. Even then, the quotas are inadequate. For families, it's $226,000 per year, plus the what's called immediate relatives, which is the one thing that is working in the system, which is spouses and children of U.S. citizens who are able, who are outside that quota, and again, parents of U.S. citizens where the U.S. citizen is over age 21. But that 226,000 then is further divided among preferences. There's four different categories of preferences, and no more than 7% can go to any one nationality, which further skews the quota system. For employment-based, it's 140,000 a year. Again, they are divided into five different preferences, and incidentally, all of those preferences include the spouses and children of the individual. So in the employment-based situation, the actual workers themselves is more like half or less than half of that number. So in essence, employers can sponsor somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 65,000 workers per year, which given the overall workforce is an extremely minuscule percentage. And then even within that, there is a quota for what's called lesser skilled workers. These are the farm workers, the construction workers, the people who take care of the elderly and take care of children. The quota there is 5,000 per year. And again, that includes spouses and children. So the real quota is somewhere around 2,000 a year for these workers. What happens is that because these quotas are so limited, that a backlog forms. And within that backlog, then you get into waits in the quota system that are so long that they actually become irrelevant. In the employment side, you can't change jobs while you wait, and the nature of the job itself can't change. So these days, in many instances, the wait for the quota is running somewhere around 6 years. During that 6 years, that's a lifetime in a business's cycle. And the business that exists and the job that exists today is going to be very different 6 years from now. So the employment-based system just does not work realistically. In the family system, we're talking about decades before families in some instances can be reunited. And if the children marry or pass the age of 21, in most cases they must either move to an even longer line or fall out of the line altogether. Again, this does not really support the American belief in families and the unity of families. The bottom line here is that we have a legal system that for far too many people, families, and businesses simply can't be followed. And what we need to do is change that legal system so that it meets the needs of the real world. Michelle?
Thank you, Crystal. That was excellent. Marshall?
Hi. So my message is fairly self-evident, and it follows on what Crystal just shared with us, which is that our current employment-based immigration system hurts both workers and employers. We've got a dynamic economy that has thrived in part because of its uncanny flexibility. We've been able to change rapidly to different economic circumstances and patterns, more nimbly than any other country, and that's really put us in the driver's seat of the global economy. But as Crystal has laid out, that flexibility that is kind of the hallmark of our economy stands in stark contrast to the rigid employment-based immigration system that we've got. The problems with the system are many, and they all really conspire to create an uneven playing field for both workers and employers. At the risk of oversimplifying, I think it's fair to distill the overarching problems to three. First, we've got arbitrary numerical limits and inadequate legal immigration channels that Crystal has covered. We've also got restrictions on labor mobility for temporary workers and inadequate channels for those temporary workers to become permanent residents. And then the final overarching problem is uneven or inadequate enforcement. The result of the inadequate legal channels at the low-skilled end of the workforce is that employers have uneven access to a legal workforce. Employers who decide to hire undocumented workers or turn a blind eye end up with an advantage over those who don't. And employers who deliberately hire such workers are really able to distort the playing field. But the unequal conditions that confront employers create even more serious inequities for workers. Undocumented workers, for example, cannot assert their rights and are susceptible to serious wage violations and other abuse. Similarly situated U.S. workers are then put in the untenable position of trying to compete with workers who can be easily manipulated. That's created, I think, as one of our colleagues has said, a trap door in the wage floor. And temporary workers on the low-skilled end are also vulnerable to exploitation. There have been many documented abuses in the H-2A and H-2B programs, including wage violations, fraudulent representations about the nature of the job, squalid living conditions for H-2A workers, et cetera. And I'm not here to try to represent that those conditions are commonplace, but they do exist and they persist because workers in those programs have very little practical legal recourse. Their employers hold enormous power over them in large part because the workers aren't allowed to go simply quit and find another employer to work for. To really protect themselves, they need the ability to change employers more freely. As with the undocumented workers, the very fact that these workers are exploitable and that employers have a different degree of leverage over them ends up hurting similarly situated U.S. workers. On the high-skilled end, there are also problems with wage abuse and worker mistreatment, although they're not nearly as stark as in the low-skilled industries. As with most government benefits programs, there is some fraud in the H-1B program that was documented by USCIS last year in a report. And the enforcement efforts to root out fraud, I think, have been under-resourced and relatively lackluster. But more problematic, I think, in terms of kind of the systemic problems confronting high-skilled immigration programs are again, the limitations on labor mobility for high-skilled temporary workers. Those restrictions end up allowing employers to exert disproportionate leverage over foreign workers, even if they don't do so intentionally or with any kind of malicious intent. By the nature of their relationship, they do have excessive leverage. And when a worker is bound to a single employer, it impacts other similarly situated U.S. workers employed either by the same employer or by competitors in the industry. So this is all to say that that while the employment-based immigration system is critical to our long-term economic success, there's some very serious flaws in it that allow both U.S. workers to be exploited, immigrant workers and U.S. workers to be exploited, and that create an uneven playing field for employers at both the high-skilled and low-skilled.
Thank you so much, Marshall.
You're welcome.
And now, Mary Giovannoli.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Marshall and Crystal, for joining us and discussing these problems today. I think that what we're already seeing is that the immigration crisis that we face is very complicated. And I come at it from a slightly different perspective, having started at the INS back in 1996, the same day that the 1996 immigration reforms went into effect. My career is sort of paralleled. I think the challenges and the limitations that the immigration laws create for users of the system and for the government itself, because essentially broken laws equal broken government, and so it's extraordinarily difficult for folks to do a good job if they're under-resourced and are working with laws that simply don't adequately address the very fluid situation that immigration really is. So I just want to quickly highlight three of the areas that I look at as sort of structural failures within sort of the current immigration system and the underlying laws that I think ultimately have a pretty dramatic effect on our economic, our political, and even our cultural well-being. And I think one of the best places to start, really, that we discuss in the report is that we're really being very short-sighted in how we even finance the workings of our immigration programs, particularly the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, because that agency really doesn't have the funding it needs to be able to quickly process applications, particularly naturalization applications, and nor does it, or really any place in the government, have the funds necessary to provide for a really adequate mechanism for encouraging integration into this country. And I think that we've all heard of the numerous backlogs that have developed over the years, in part because of the structural issues described, but they also are sometimes attributable to the mere fact that the agency can't always do everything it needs to do because the money isn't there. And it is unfortunate, but the way this part of our immigration system is structured, it's entirely fee-funded under law, or not entirely, but the majority is fee-funded under law, and the agency is really required to pay for to pay its own way through the fees of those who apply. And so what that ends up doing really is creating, I think, a very short-sighted approach, because we're really not in a position to be able to give people the attention they deserve, or to create the fund or provide the funds that are necessary to provide a really customer-friendly atmosphere, which has often been a criticism aimed at USCIS, and yet there isn't the underlying support to recognize that immigration matters, and therefore some of the costs should be borne by the government, because there are tremendous benefits to having a robust immigration system. And I think it's further complicated by the fact that you can't really even borrow from Peter to pay Paul, because there are very complex budgeting and other spending mechanisms in place that, for instance, make it difficult for the agency to anticipate a large program and hire up for it, even if they know fees are coming in, because there's no real mechanism for them to sort of borrow against that group. So that's sort of an underlying structural problem that really has to be addressed to create, I think, a 21st century immigration system. But I think it's also the case that our laws have become so much more complicated in an effort to try to stop the flow of immigration without really thinking through the consequences of those laws. And I think what we find is that historically immigration restrictions backfire. So for instance, going back to my time with the INS starting in 1996, many of those laws really were designed, I think, to try to cut off access to forms of relief. But in the process, what has happened is that it's actually eliminated a lot of the safety valves that existed in our immigration system prior to 1996. So there was a little bit of a balancing and an ebb and flow, because someone might be arrested and put in immigration proceedings, but there were a number of avenues for which they could go to an immigration judge and they could say, yes, I'm in the country illegally, but I've worked here for 7 years, I have U.S. citizen children, I have been paying my taxes, I have good moral character, and then be able to petition the judge to grant them relief, despite basically say, yes, you were here illegally, but you've demonstrated that you merit further consideration and can stay. And from 1996 and going forward, the capacity and the ability for government to make those kinds of calls has really, really been limited. And so what you've done is create a situation where there's really no place for people to go. They can't get into the legal immigration system. They don't have relief available through the immigration courts as they used to. They're afraid to go home because there are additional laws that make it difficult once you've left to ever come back, all things that we outline in the report. And so you actually have the sort of counterintuitive effect of, by getting tougher on people, just really making the process more difficult and making the growth of the undocumented population much, much larger, because there are just no safety valves to provide other alternatives to people. And so, frankly, I think that in rethinking this debate, part of what we have to do is realize that we have to sort of understand that the arguments for legalization and visa reform and many other things it's not new. It's about correcting the system and finding that right balance so that we can actually regulate our immigration system better. And so it's important to sort of look historically and broadly about how these different pieces fit together. And then the final thing I'll say before turning it back over to Michelle is that what has also happened in the last 10 years as we've really turned more towards a deportation-driven culture, we are letting that sort of creep into a number of other aspects of American life. And I remember years ago training trial attorneys in the Immigration Service on asylum issues and saying, look, you know, as the government attorney, it's your job to make sure the truth gets out. And I remember one student saying to me, well, why do I have to do that? That's not my job. My job is to deport people. And, you know, that it was stunning to me to hear that, but and to many of the other students, too. But that is an attitude that continues, unfortunately, to exist in many parts of DHS and the various agencies. And it's a cultural shift that really we have to work hard to revisit. Because, in fact, enforcing immigration laws shouldn't be just about how many people you can deport and how quickly. It should be about making sure that all of the immigration laws, which include naturalization and adjustment of status and asylum and a variety of other forms of relief, are fairly and justly enforced. And as we've sort of tilted the balance too far, I think, to the strict sort of deportation-driven side, we've lost sight of that other aspect of immigration. And unfortunately, I think that then has crept into things that we're seeing in state and local law enforcement of immigration laws, in state and city ordinances that attempt to ban illegal immigrants from their jurisdiction, and even the growing intolerance, I think, that we have for people of other colors and cultures. Is all really, to some extent, tied to this deportation-driven mentality. And if we don't step back from that and, again, try to rebalance things, it really is something that doesn't just hurt the immigrants in the system, but every one of us who are part and parcel of the country. And so Michelle is going to talk a little bit more about some of the specific ways that these problems have evolved in the enforcement deportation-driven culture. So I'll turn it back to her.
Thank you so much, Mary. So we've seen that the problems with the current immigration system are myriad and go well beyond the 12 million unauthorized immigrants that we usually think of. Families are waiting for decades to enter the U.S. legally. Other families are being torn apart. Some employers can't get the workers that they need, and others are exploiting their workforce and harming all workers. So what has our solution been until now? Well, to a large degree, we've been throwing more and more money at enforcing our current broken laws and labeling more and more immigrants as criminals. There are those people who do think that the answer is simply enforcing the laws that are on the book. But I think we've seen that some of those laws, at least, are broken. And we've seen that enforcement alone is not effectively resolving illegal immigration, let alone all of the other structural problems with the system. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has spent billions and billions of dollars on ineffective border enforcement. Since 1992, the annual budget of the U.S. Border Patrol has increased by 714%. And at the same time, the number of Border Patrol agents stationed along the southwest border has grown by 390%. Yet, despite all that, the number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. has roughly tripled from 3.5 million in 1990 to 12 million in 2008. And many of them didn't even cross the border illegally, but they came to the U.S. on valid visas and then stayed after their visas expired. So that means that all the border enforcement is really irrelevant to a large portion of the illegal population. So what has all of the spending on the border accomplished? Well, today the border is definitely a much more dangerous and expensive place to cross. And as a result, more and more migrants are dying. And today we see approximately one death per day along the border. According to a new report that was recently released, at least 5,607 deaths have occurred along the U.S.-Mexico border between 1994 and 2008, which is three times the number of people who died in Hurricane Katrina. Because of increased enforcement and its associated risks, we've created a network of professional smugglers who are profiting from increased border enforcement and charging more and more to bring immigrants across that border. Another result of increased enforcement is that unauthorized immigrants are now staying permanently in the U.S. rather than traveling back and forth between the U.S. and their home country. Mexican migrants in particular used to have this circular migration pattern. But now the circular flow of migration has become permanent migration, and undocumented immigrants are staying permanently in the United States, and moreover, they're bringing their family members to the United States with them. So now we're seeing even more mothers and children running the gauntlet across the border and risking their lives. We've also seen increased interior enforcement within the borders of the U.S. that results in criminalizing large numbers of immigrants, as well as mistakes and civil rights violations, many of which affect U.S. citizens and legal immigrants as well. So this is readily apparent when we notice that the immigration detention business has been booming. Just since 2005, ICE detention bed space has increased 78%. And during 2008 alone, ICE detained a record 378,582 persons. And contrary to what many people believe, these detainees are not all unauthorized immigrants. Many of them are long-term legal residents who have been made deportable through the changes in the laws that Mary alluded to earlier. Our interior enforcement, such as the E-Verify system, has also been ineffective, has not stopped the flow of undocumented immigration, and it's also had a harmful impact on U.S. citizens and legal workers. In fact, many of the things that we do in the name of immigration enforcement have an impact that go well beyond the undocumented population. Nationwide, we know there are approximately 4 million U.S. citizen children with at least one undocumented parent, and policies meant to target the illegal population also impact their U.S. citizen children. U.S. citizens are also affected by programs that paint with too broad a brush or when mistakes are made, and we know that there are just too many cases of U.S. citizens who have been mistakenly stopped, questioned, detained, and even deported. In communities where local police are working with ICE to enforce federal immigration laws, immigrant communities are frightened and less willing to cooperate with police. And when immigrants are afraid, they're reluctant to report crimes that they've witnessed or been victims of, and that makes everybody in the community much less safe. If my neighbor sees someone breaking into my house, but my neighbor is undocumented or is even a legal immigrant but has undocumented family members and is afraid to share the identity of that person with the police, that's harmful to me. That means that my crime isn't getting solved. And local enforcement of immigration laws is also redirecting scarce resources towards immigration enforcement and away from other crime-solving activities, again, making me and my family and my home less safe. So in other words, the U.S. continues to spend billions of dollars along the border and in the interior of the U.S., and for all the money spent, we've actually witnessed an increase until recently in the number of unauthorized immigrants. Moreover, legal immigrants are being detained and deported in increasing numbers, and entire American communities are feeling threatened, and our neighborhoods are less safe. We know that no enforcement measure alone can resolve the problems with the current system, and we can't continue to think that we can enforce our way out of this situation. We need to broaden the scope of the discussion and look beyond enforcement and beyond the 12 million and address the other problems with the current legal immigration system that have resulted in the large undocumented population in the first place, let alone the millions of workers and family members waiting to enter the U.S. legally. The larger structural problems with the system must be addressed as well. Like I mentioned earlier, IPC, over the next few weeks, will be releasing a series of papers that will be focused on the solutions to these various problems. So I think with that, we will open up the line for your questions. Megan, can you please give us instructions how to get in line to ask a question?
Yes, ma'am. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. That's star and one to ask a question. Please keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star and one to ask a question. We'll pause momentarily to give all participants the chance to queue. And it looks like our first question will come from Ben Salazar of Nuestro Mundo. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon here in Omaha, Nebraska. As someone who has lived and worked the majority of my lifetime among and with Latinos and nowadays the growing Latino immigrant population of Omaha, Nebraska, I don't think that Americans fully appreciate the breadth of social problems that this broken immigration system has further caused to grow among the cities across America. And I don't think that people understand the depth of these issues that face the Latino community, the Latino immigrant community, and the Latino community in which they live. Because I think, as somebody noted earlier, the direct impact of this broken immigration system affects not only the Latino immigrant, but most often because they choose to live with people like myself who are first, second, third, fourth Latino or Mexican-American descendants. They bring a plethora of problems with them, not necessarily caused by themselves, but because of the larger society pinpoints them as potential victims, as scapegoats, and everything else you can name. I just came, for example, from a meeting with a legal aid director here at Omaha to see if we can't help to address the issue of domestic violence. And I think it was Ms. Waslin who was mentioning, to some extent, alluding to these social ills that the broken immigration system fosters. One of them is domestic violence. You know, there are a lot of single men that have crossed over, and this is traditional, from Mexico and other Latin American countries to work, but because they can't return as easily as they did before, they stay. They stay rooted. They want to form relationships. There's many single moms that are in the same or similar situations, and because of culture, because of language, because of fear of authorities and the police, we have a growing epidemic of domestic abuse that goes unreported or underreported. I don't have a specific question, but my concern, okay, my observation and my concern is that Americans don't fully understand the depth of the social ills that impact the Latino and Latino immigrant community because we don't have an easier way to allow immigrants to become legal in this country. It's a broader scale of problems that face our communities than what people see on the outside. That's my observation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think that's a really astute observation, and I think that today's call, as well as many of the other things that our organizations are doing, are really meant to educate the broader public about these issues, and we're hoping that the media will also work with us to educate the public about these social ills and other problems caused by the broken immigration system. Megan, do we have another question in line?
Yes, we do. It looks like our next question will come from Juan Esparza from Vida en el Val. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My question is pretty simple. I know that there's talk about immigration reform being presented sometime this year or early next year. On the situations that you folks have outlined this morning here in California, at least, does that legislation or proposals address some of the concerns that you guys have and that we'll most likely be able to see when you come out with your solution-oriented papers in the upcoming weeks? But does the current anything that you've seen thus far, are they addressing your concerns?
Great question, Juan. Who wants to take that one?
Hi, Kate. This is Marshall. This is Marshall from Center for American Progress. So far, there isn't a piece of legislation that's on the table. We believe that any comprehensive solution to the problems plaguing our system would obviously have to address all of the issues that we've raised. I think that based on the past immigration reform debates, the one in the 109th and 110th Congresses in 2006 and 2007, we have a pretty clear sense that that these issues will be addressed. The question will always be how well they are addressed, and are they addressed, with sufficient vision to ensure that there is not a duplication of the problems that we're experiencing now in 10 or 15 or 20 years. So the short answer is there is no legislation out there, so nothing that any of us have seen or could talk about directly speaks to these issues, but we do think that the entire basket of problems that we've addressed or laid out this morning will be at the very least part of the discussion in legislation that gets drafted.
Thank you.
And it does look like – excuse me, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you if we have any more questions in line.
Oh, yes. Our next question will come from Rita Girona Adkins from Asian Fortune. Your line is open.
Thank you so much. Yes, this is Rita Girona Adkins. I write for Asian Pacific American audiences, including the Philippine News and Asian Fortune. I have a quick question. Any comment regarding the Vitter amendment? This has nothing directly got to do with immigration, but it certainly impacts the immigrant community. The Vitter resolution, which is to include in the 2010 census questionnaire, the status of the respondent, whether legal or illegal, your comment on how you think it would affect especially the immigrant population. And also, just very quickly, is that when the immigration bill eventually is given its day to be revisited in Congress to be part of the legislature, when it is reintroduced, now there is sort of two schools of thought, which is, of course, maintaining there is a support for maintaining the family-based kind of policy. Now, there's also the other school of thought, which is to give preference to people, applicants, on the basis of skills. According to the point system, people were talking about the point system. Now, if you have any comment as to whether, if the point system becomes the more pervasive thrust of the new immigration bill legislation when it is introduced, how much chances do you think that the family-based kind of strategy would continue to be a pervasive part of the bill, because that's the concern. The family type of immigration is precisely the topmost concern of the Asian Pacific Americans. Thank you so much for your answers.
Thanks, Rita. So we have Vitter and family immigration.
Yes. I can start with Vitter. This is Mary Giovanoli from the Immigration Policy Center. Rita, we actually just wrote a blog post about this that posted last night on immigrationimpact.org. But the short answer, I think, on Vitter is that I think it's very, very short-sighted, particularly from a senator from Louisiana who certainly his constituents know how important it is for people to be accurately counted and provided with federal funding. Given what happened in Hurricane Katrina, it's very short-sighted to try to tie the census to immigration in any way. Not only do we know that it will probably discourage people from coming forward and being counted for fear that they might get swept up into some kind of net, legal and illegal folks, but more to the point, that's not what the census is for under the Constitution, and it's just unfortunate to see immigration being used as essentially a political wedge issue, which we seem to see on virtually every issue that comes down the pike these days. And it's yet another reason why I think that those of us who really look at the need to solve immigration in a comprehensive way have really tried to stress to policymakers that, you know, until we deal with the immigration crisis in its own terms, we are going to continue to see people trying to kidnap the issue for their own ends. And I think, you know, the Vitter Amendment on the census is another example of that. I'll segue quickly to your family question, but then if anyone else wants to add in, you know, I think that the question of how we get the right mix of folks into the country for future immigration, legal immigration, is a really important question, and it's one that doesn't have a set answer. I think that one of the mistakes that we saw in the 2007 debate was that the point system that was proposed was, you know, very quickly and haphazardly put together. It didn't really necessarily have any grounding in what the impact of point systems in other countries were. And, in fact, a lot of the times those kinds of systems don't get the mix of folks you need, and they do often ignore the importance that family members contribute that can't easily be quantified. And so, you know, I think that it's very important for people to continue to point out to people who are seeking to restrict the legal immigration family mechanisms that family provides a huge network of support to help individuals prosper and grow and to help the community prosper and grow. And like I said, I think one of the mistakes of last time was that we didn't necessarily keep talking about those issues in a connected way, and I think we all need to be very reflective on that as we go into the next round of legislation.
Just a quick follow-up question, if I may. There is also a subtext to the point system, which is that if the selection basis would be based on skills, then one could sort of generally or loosely assume that people coming from less developed countries who might not have higher points, I mean many more points, you know, in the point system to be more eligible to come to the U.S. So there's a subtext there of sort of a discriminatory kind of effect.
I think you're right, that subtext is there.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rita. Do we have another question in the line?
Yes, and as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, it's star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll go next to Sanai Perez from Aldeo Newspaper. Your line is now open.
Hi, my question is in regards to the DREAM Act. And do you think that the DREAM Act has a better chance of passing if it were to stand alone rather than if it were to be bundled with immigration reform?
Thanks. Marshall, are you able to take that one?
Sure. I mean, it's a hard hypothetical to answer, and I guess I would suggest that it's one we probably aren't going to have to grapple with. You know, we saw in the last Congress the comprehensive effort fail, and then 4 months later we saw a vote on the DREAM Act fail in the Senate. So, but I don't necessarily think that the 2007 comprehensive vote or the 2007 DREAM vote reflect where members would be today, and certainly, you know, hope we have a better piece of legislation to work with than we did in 2007 in terms of the comprehensive bill. I think that there's a commitment by everyone who cares about the immigration policy issues to move forward on comprehensive immigration reform first. If that were to fail for some reason, would DREAM have a chance of making it over the finish line? You know, again, that's a hypothetical that I don't think that we should probably speculate about. But I do think that one thing is clear, which is that the DREAM Act provisions will be included in any comprehensive bill, and I think all of the organizations represented on this call will be, strongly supportive of pushing that comprehensive effort forward. And I think it, I think I can speak for everyone on this call that we're also all very supportive of the DREAM Act and protecting the kids that have been you know, so adversely affected by our current immigration laws.
Thanks, Marshall. I just want to remind people that the paper that IPC is releasing today is available at our website, immigrationpolicy.org. And also, if anybody has follow-up questions for any of the speakers, you can contact our communications manager, Wendy Sefsaf, and her number is 202-507-7524, and she can put you in touch with any of today's speakers. Megan, how are we doing with the queue? Do we have another question?
Yes, it looks like we do have another question. It comes from the site of Javier Rodriguez from ZMAG.org. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was very elucidating, your presentations, or they were very elucidating. Listen, I'm highly involved in the organizing and political process to make sure that hopefully this year, this coming year, it looks like this year is not going to happen, we will be able to pass a comprehensive immigration reform. And what I wanted to ask, and it's simple, but of course highly hypothetical, what do you see the possibilities? I see it as very positive, you know, that we will be having a bill passed early next year in the first half. What do you think about that?
Thanks, Javier. Would anybody like to respond to that?
Just pick on us, Michelle, if we can. Okay, this is Mary. I think that is, I mean, that's, I think, what we're all hoping for, you know, the political framework and calendar can change daily. But I think that there are a lot of positive signs that people are working towards that kind of framework, and I think that there's a lot of hard work ahead to get to the point where legislation passes, but it strikes me that it really is inevitable, and it's just a question of, I think, the political will in Congress matching up with what you know, is, I think, clearly public sentiment for solving this problem. Marshall, did you want to add something?
No, I think that's fair. I think the congressional calendar is obviously very crowded. There are a lot of major initiatives underway. I think that immigration reform is certainly among them. We're going to, you know, be pushing really hard to see that it happens. And I think, as Mary said, the question is really when, not if. And you know, your question is to whether when is in the first 6 months of next year. That is certainly our intention, and we aim to do everything possible to make that happen.
Thanks, Marshall and Mary. Do we have another question in line?
Yes, our next question will come from Adebi Durango Adam from Applied Research. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. I'm very glad I was able to listen in to this conversation. I'd like to thank you for taking this question. What was mentioned was that we need an analysis of structural issues surrounding migration policies. And in effecting this type of analysis, sort of throw it out to all the speakers, what would a forward-thinking migration policy look like, especially in consideration, I would say, of its effects on communities of color? We need a new vision of immigration, as was mentioned, but what does this vision look like? In particular, I'd like to know what you think about the role of journalists in this vision. More generally, how do activists collectively consider immigration reform and then form a new model that's not based on designating immigrants as a problem from the outset? Said differently, I guess my basic question would be, what would an inclusive model migration policy look like?
Thanks for the question. I think that, like I mentioned, over the next couple of weeks, IPC is going to be releasing, you know, a series of papers and having other calls similar to this one, really trying to lay out what the solution is and what a truly comprehensive immigration solution looks like. So stay tuned. But in the meantime, would any of our speakers like to just give a quick response to the question?
I'm not sure it lends itself to a quick response, unfortunately. It's a pretty this is Crystal Williams. It's a pretty complex question with a lot of layers of issues to it. Certainly, it needs to acknowledge the needs that immigrants fill in our society, the needs for technological and scientific leadership, the needs for social leadership, the needs for basic services as well, and then the basic human needs of families. So all of those elements have to be acknowledged. The thing is, economically, employers and employees will find one another one way or another, and we need a legal system that facilitates them finding one another rather than sending them underground into abusive, sometimes abusive situations in order to find each other. So it's got to be real world. That's first and foremost. And the elements of that would have to include realistic quotas, systems that are not based on a quota system that's not based on nationality, but instead is based on merit, need, and family values.
Okay. Megan, do we have another question in line?
Yes, our next question will come from Loke Nguyen from Catholic Charities of Los Angeles. Your line is open.
Thank you. I just a great concern about a discrepancy between the immigration laws and versus the consulate interviews of those immigration and immigrant family. That's a bureaucracy and there's a discrepancy and there's a lot of concern about the interviews and applying to the immigration laws versus the USCIS. And I just wonder that Escalate Ayla will bring that and consider that is into the reforms and why not have the immigration officer go to the overseas and working instead of the consulate. That is my concern.
So are you proposing that USCIS officers conduct the interviews in consulates rather than consular officers?
Yes.
Is that... What would be the reason for that?
The reason is I see because the USCIS reviewed the applications and approve and decide the proof or deny, but the consulate overseas may interpret the different way and a different interpret the law in different way.
Okay.
And also bureaucracy, and then they will not make decision. They have to send back to the USCIS for review. And those review, and I think mm-hmm. is create a bureaucracy, and then sometime is conflict between the laws and versus the interviewer. And I just wonder why they don't put it together or they let the USCIS interview.
Well, certainly you raise some issues that do need to be addressed, and the discrepancy in how consular officers and how USCIS might view any particular issue is a major issue that does need to be addressed, if not legislatively, then at least administratively.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Megan, I think we're going to have to make this our last question. Do we have another one in the queue?
Yes, our last question will come from Trudy Krasovic from the switchboard of Miami Crisis Line. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to listen to the experts. My question is very quick. I read something that I want to see if this is true. Is it true that if there is a bill in Congress about immigration reform, the president itself can do an executive order and sign, and he doesn't need the approval of Congress for that?
That is absolutely not true.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you to everybody who asked questions. Thank you to everybody for being on the call with us this afternoon. Again, if you have any follow-up questions for speakers, you can contact Wendy Sussaf at 202-507-7524, and we look forward to hearing from you on some future calls.